This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with author Maureen Webb about her recent book, Illusions of Security: Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World.
Does the fact that the government knows your face print, your eye print, your hand print make us any safer? Does the fact that it has a worldwide database with your name, social security number, and all this other biometric material make us safer? Maureen Webb doesn't think so.
Stanley Aronowitz, author of Left Turn, joins us in the second part of the program for a roundtable discussion on many topics, including ways to organize a sustained resistance to war. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Over the last couple of years on Law and Disorder, we spent a lot of time covering in depth the scope of the surveillance state that is now affecting all of us in the United States and in the world. Today, we're really excited to have with us Maureen Webb, the author of a new book on security. The new book is called Illusions of Security: Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Maureen Webb is a human rights lawyer in Canada, and in this book, she examines how governments worldwide are following the lead of the Bush administration to make us into not just a surveillance country, but a surveillance world.
Maureen Webb, down here from Canada, doing the same kind of stuff up there that we're trying to do on Law and Disorder here. A big welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael.
We have your book, Illusions of Security. I started reading it last night. Good job.
Thank you.
You know, we've been doing the kind of thing that you're doing for almost 3 years here on Law and Disorder. You've taken it a step higher because you not only talk about what's going on in the United States in terms of surveillance, but how they're doing it globally. Tell me, what's your thinking on what's been happening since 9/11?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of initiatives that have been introduced by governments around the world, often through international forums like the G8, International Civil Aviation Organization. The population, even the well-attuned population like you and I, are very unaware of. And these are initiatives that surveil entire populations. And that's what I talk about in my book, and their effect on democratic societies.
Can you give us a few examples of the technologies being used?
Yes. In the book, I talk about how governments are now biometrically registering populations with biometric identity documents.
What does that mean?
Biometrics is the use of biological traits that human beings have to identify people. So, for instance, fingerprints are the most well-known, but also things like iris scans, digital recordings of our faces, the dimensions of our faces, and biometric technology records those biometric identifiers and stores them either in a database or in a computer chip that can be embedded in an identity
document. Where do they get that from? I mean, where do they get your fingerprints from, your face, your eyes? What?
Well, it's interesting. Since 9/11, they started biometrically registering marginal populations. So, for example, the National Entry Exit Security Registration Program, right after 9/11, the government systematically registered all males between the ages of 16 and 45.
Is this your government in Canada or ours here in the States?
That's yours in the States.
How about yours?
Is that everybody who comes in and out of the United States?
All visitors or people traveling to or through the United States from Muslim countries, and their fingerprints were taken.
Oh, it's from Muslim countries in particular.
Exactly. So there was a sort of an ethnic profiling that was done. Then that registration was expanded to all visitors through the U.S. visit program. And then it was expanded even more widely to citizens through biometric passports, which my government and yours agreed to in the G8 forums.
What's a biometrics passport?
Well, it's a biometric. My country is using digital face recognition, but countries in the EU are using fingerprints.
So wait, your face is now in your passport somehow?
That's right.
Not just as a picture, but in some other measurement.
As a digital photograph.
Does that mean there is a radio frequency identification chip in each passport?
Yes. The governments are also putting RFID chips into passports.
Which governments?
In the ICAO, that's the International Civil Aviation Organization, specifications, they call for RFID chips to be inserted so that the information in the passport can be read at a distance.
And which governments are going to be doing this?
Many governments around the world. Yours, mine, governments in Europe, governments in Asia. And in the United States, it was revealed that this could be very dangerous for Americans, because anybody with an RFID reader in a crowd could pick out Americans for targeting. Also, identity thieves or terrorists could read the information and copy it so that they could be identity fraud. And the government, its solution was to put a foil, a metal foil, into the passport so that it couldn't be read surreptitiously. But then you have to wonder, why do they have them in the first place? If you have to open them up and read them closely, what's the difference between having, the RFID and an ordinary contact chip?
Well, where we started the conversation was you're saying they were getting biometric information on marginal populations and then on passports.
Yeah.
So I guess the next question is, why do they need that? It seems less to me that it's about the passport than about getting that information to some massive database. Is that right?
Right. Once you have a biometric identity document, and I didn't finish, after they introduced biometric passports, the UK, Canada, and the US, all common law countries in which we have always resisted the imposition of a national identity card, the governments floated the idea of identity cards. It was shot down very quickly in each country by the democratic houses of government. But after the biometric passport was imposed, the idea was resurrected again. And in the UK and the US, the legislation was rammed through the Houses of Government. In the U.S., you have a de facto identity card with the standardization of your driver's licenses and the linkage of the state information in the driver's license. This is an identity card that you have to carry around all the time.
Let me ask you about the driver's license. They haven't done that yet. I mean, my driver's license is still an old New York City or state driver's license. But is it going to be required that every state has these standardized driver's license with this information?
That's right. So when you renew your driver's license, over time the whole population will have a standardized card with databases that are linked. In the U.S., Congress voted the Real ID Act down in 2004, and in 2005 the government attached it to a must-pass bill raising funds for the troops in Iraq. And it was rammed through.
Maureen, give us an idea of some of the other stuff that they're doing, not only in the United States, but abroad.
Yeah. Well, once governments have a biometric identity document for everybody in their population and in foreign populations, the idea is that they have a sort of gold standard for identifying people so that they know who they're dealing with. But of course, biometrics is a highly flawed technology. It has high error rates, even for the best biometrics. And so, millions of people will still be vulnerable to mistaken identity. Once they have that identifier for everybody is registered, they can start linking information so that since 9/11, they're starting to gather from many, many sources of information about people, information that they've never had access to before. So, for example, in the U.S., many people would be surprised to know that the government buys personal information on American citizens from commercial data aggregators like DoubleClick and ChoicePoint. DoubleClick boasts that it has information on 90 million households in the U.S. They're buying information on foreign citizens through hook or by crook. They managed to obtain, for example, the entire voter registry of Mexico. They are asking companies to give them information, and companies are falling over themselves to hand over the information.
Where does the information all go?
Well, it goes into various databases, and, you know, many databases are converging. So, for example, in my country, we recently had a linkage of all Justice Department-related and immigration-related databases. It's called the Justice sort of supercomputer. There's greater access for government and law enforcement to be able to access databases. So they don't necessarily have to be physically linked as long as they're accessible.
And would that be medical and governmental and consumer?
Yes, it's a mixture of public and private sector databases. So, for example, the U.S. Visit Program links about 20 federal databases plus commercial databases. The CAPS-2 program, which was the computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system, it was supposed to link public databases with an unlimited number of commercial databases. Programs like Total Information Awareness, which was killed by Congress, but insiders say that it, you know, it's just a shell game. The different areas of it have pushed off into other programs. And like ADVISE, which is another new one, they aim to, quote, mine the transaction space, unquote. Their aim is to sort of just suck up all the information that's available about people in electronic form. On their website, TIA talked about medical records, employment records, housing records, driver's records,
TIA was,
licensing records.
What's TIA?
It was run out of DARPA.
But what's it, what does the initial stand for?
Total Information Awareness.
And Americans found that just a bit too creepy. Right. So they changed it to Terrorist Information Awareness.
Right. We're talking with Maureen Webb. She's the author of Illusions of Security. It's a wonderful book on the global surveillance and democracy in the post-9/11 world. And, of course, it has an interesting name, Illusions of Security. You've been talking about all these systems of getting information, biometrics, from passports to driver's license to everything else. But you somehow don't think that's making us more secure. Is that right?
That's right. These new initiatives don't make us more secure. They create only the illusions of
security. And why is that?
Because they don't work. The premise is flawed. The premise is that if you watch everybody all the time, you'll be more secure. That's the logic of police states. That's the logic of the Stasi. The information that they use is often incorrect, incomplete, uncontextualized, and there's no mechanisms for individuals to see that information or to correct it. And the technology is flawed. As I said, biometrics have high rates of error. And the data mining technology that we haven't spoken about yet, which is the high-tech way of sifting through these oceans of information to sort populations, not to look for known terrorists or people who are suspected of terrorism on reasonable grounds, but to predict who among us might be a terrorist. I mean, how Kafkaesque is that?
Right.
This is very highly flawed technology, too, and it's being used in Europe and the United States. In Canada, we have a center called the National Risk Assessment Center, which is essentially a data mining program. It assigns risk scores to individuals. This is
amazing.
Highly flawed technology, too, because, of course, it's not interested in accuracy. What it's trying to do is to preempt and predict.
Maureen, can you give us an example or two of the kind of risk factors that these computers are set up to look for?
Well, they're secret, so we don't know for sure. For example, in Germany, they have a program called TRODS, a trawling program. And it was set up to run the profile of the people from the Hamburg cell of Al-Qaeda against whole populations. So, you know, but you can imagine, these are very wide markers of so-called terrorist activity. So they were looking for young guys from Muslim countries who were students, you know, and so they captured thousands of students in that dragnet. I met a young guy in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and he said that he and his dad had been stopped for extra airport screening because they had a one-way ticket to Florida.
Well, you know, when you mentioned the German case, it's interesting because the Center for Constitutional Rights initially represented Kurnaz, who was taken to Guantanamo, and he was German, and it was a mistake. But he was picked up in one of these kinds of associations through this kind of information, that he knew someone who knew someone from the Hamburg cell, supposedly, and they claimed he knew a suicide bomber, but of course the suicide bomber never was a suicide bomber, it was somebody else. So there's an example to me of one of the mistakes. One of the other ones you mentioned in your book is another both center case as well as a case that was obviously very prominent in Canada, is Maher Arar.
Yes.
How does that case fit into what you're saying about illusions of security and mistakes?
Yeah. Well, I talk about high-tech and low-tech risk assessment. The high-tech risk assessment is the data mining technology I've been talking about. Low-tech risk assessment is a world in which bureaucrats have high incentives to err on the side of caution. They're given mandates of preemption, of prevention. No one wants to be the person that fails to flag a terrorist. And I talk about all kinds of things like indefinite detention, the sweeps that happened after 9/11 that swept up hundreds of immigrants in the United States, torture. You know, this is...
These are all our cases.
Yeah, exactly. This is the low-tech area of risk assessment. And the mayor, the case of Mayor Arar shows the consequences, the potential consequences of a negative risk assessment.
Let me just remind our listeners who that is. Mayor Arar was the Canadian citizen who was taken off a plane at Kennedy. He was transiting from Tunisia back to Canada. He was taken off and sent by the United States government to Syria, where he was tortured underground cell for 10 months or so. He's finally out, and the Canadians just, in a major settlement, gave him $9 million U.S. for their part in the plot. The U.S., of course, is still keeping him out of the country. But
that's right.
Yeah. His crime was talking to somebody about buying a computer printer, I think.
That's right. He had lunch with somebody.
Yeah.
is there anything else you want to say about
Mark? I want to say a couple of things. There's several points in which that case had aspects of this global surveillance infrastructure that I'm talking about. The investigations, the AO Canada investigation in Toronto and Ottawa, which picked him up along with some other Canadians, it was an integrated national security enforcement team where Mounties worked with the FBI and we think the CIA with absolutely no sovereign checks and balances, no controls over how information was shared. And this is one of the examples I talk about of how information is converging and being shared with little or no control by countries after 9/11. And it also shows how indiscriminately they're interpreting information and their indiscriminate actions when they interpret information. So, for example, the Mounties, they had characterized Mayor Arar as a person of interest. He wasn't a target. He wasn't, you know, they had nothing that suggested that he was involved in terrorist activity at all. But because he knew a target, he had had lunch with the target, he became a person of interest. But at the same time, they were giving mixed messages to the FBI and the CIA. They were saying that he and his wife were Muslim fanatics and that he had been in Washington on 9/11, which was completely false. Right. The Americans picked him up when they were alerted by advanced passenger information, which is another part of the global surveillance infrastructure, where state agencies get information on passengers.
They send them in advance. Like if I get on a plane in Tunisia, they'll send it to the U.S.
That's right. And there's advanced passenger information, which is basically the manifest for the who's on the plane. And there's also passenger name record information, which includes up to 65 fields of information. So they picked him up with this. And then they rendered him to torture in Syria. So it shows the globalized aspect of the infrastructure and the indiscriminate interpretations of information.
I just wanted to remind Law and Disorder listeners, I'm here with Heidi Boghossian and Michael Ratner. I'm Michael Smith. We're speaking with the author of the just-released book, Maureen Webb has written Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. It's a dynamite book. We urge all of you to get it. Maureen, I wanted to ask you, what was it that led you to write this book?
Well, I came to this subject matter really as a mother and a lawyer. you know, we got a bad name these days, and we deserve it. I think lawyers have a particular responsibility because our profession is going to have a lot to answer for at the end of this era. I came to New York the week that to take up a fellowship at Columbia University the week that 9/11 happened. And at the time, my son was 5 months old. I just finished breastfeeding him, and my daughter was three, and you know, we were here when the anthrax attacks happened, and I was terrified. The woman that died was in our postal district. But at the same time, as a lawyer, listening to the debate unfold in political and academic circles, I was, I wanted governments to catch the terrorists as much as anybody, but I was deeply troubled by the direction that that policy was going, aided by lawyers who were coming up with ideas, these really evil doctrines of enemy combatant, preemptive war. As a lawyer, I guess I just became absorbed in these issues. When I went back to the to Canada, I got involved in the Campaign for Justice for Mayor Arar, and I'm co-chair of a pan-Canadian civil society organization called the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. And, that's a terrific, terrific group. In 2004, they started to understand that what was happening in our country and in the United States was not sui generis, that there seemed to be patterns around the world. So they brought the American Civil Liberties Union, State Watch from Europe, Focus on the Global South from Asia. So these major NGOs working on these issues. I think we invited the CCR too. I think they had Steve Watt from the CCR.
Oh, Steve was at CCR then. That's right.
And
I remember when he went to the meeting.
Yes, yeah. And we sat around the table for 2 days and talked about what was happening in our countries and identified patterns. Talked about how we might collaborate, and we understood that a lot of this stuff was happening in international forums. And so what was necessary to stop this stuff was an international civil society effort. We established a campaign called the International Campaign Against Mass Surveillance, and this book grew out of all of those efforts.
Good story.
What can our listeners do to advance knowledge about this and hopefully affect some kind of change?
Well, I think, there's organizations in the United States like the ACLU, CCR, the privacy organizations, EPIC, for example, that are putting out a lot of information on these things. And so, join those organizations, look at their websites, inform yourself. The message I want to give to people is we're not powerless to stop this as citizens. We need to send clear messages to our members of government to tell them that we don't want them to go down this path, that we've got to fight for our own democracies. We're not powerless to stop it.
Maureen Webb, the author of Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. We haven't had any terrible terrorist attack since 9/11 here in New York City. The people that have set up this global surveillance apparatus say, see, we've been successful. I think that's kind of analogous to saying that I keep a clove of garlic in my refrigerator and therefore I don't have any elephants in the bathroom. But in any case, it's hard to refute that. I think there's a different argument, and I think it's the argument of why anonymity is essential to a democracy. And I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on that.
Well, to begin with, there was a widely held belief after 9/11 that American security agencies should have known about the plots and prevented them. But in fact, the 9/11 Commission and the congressional inquiries into the events found that the CIA and the FBI, the traditional methods of law enforcement and security intelligence, where you're looking for specific risks in specific circles and you're working out from there on leads instead of looking at everybody all the time, the traditional methods yielded substantial information. They knew that there were Muslim fanatics that were planning an attack on U.S. soil, that were talking about using airplanes. They were tracking two of the 9/11 hijackers at the time. And the congressional inquiry found that the failure of the security establishment in the United States was that they couldn't see the bigger picture. And if they couldn't see the forest for the trees when they had specific information, how much better will they do with this ocean of information that they're collecting on, millions of innocent people? When you look at each of these programs, the people that developed biometrics say that it's a highly flawed technology. The FBI agents who received the flood of tips from the National Security Agency Domestic Spy Program said that they didn't find anything out that they didn't already know through traditional means, and that it was drowning them in tips that were diverting agents from more productive counterterrorism efforts. So if you look at each of these things, They haven't caught one terrorist with these initiatives.
Yeah, Michael Ratner's fond of saying it's just like in 1984, where you got the bad guy Goldstein out there, and they went out of their way not to catch him. You know, they don't want to catch Osama because they need that specter of evilness to justify what they're doing.
Yeah.
But let me get back to one point you made before about how they didn't see the big picture. Are you talking about what Susan Sontag, who was like the only one who tried to talk about the big picture in this country and who was cream for her efforts, the big picture being simply this, that the role that the United States plays in the oppression of people in the Middle East is horrific. And we have to have a discussion about that, a discussion about the Palestinians, discussion about the lack of democracy in Saudi Arabia and so on. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Well, I talk about the neoconservative plans that were developing in think tanks a decade before 9/11 happened, and how they were really preaching a doctrine of preemption. They were already talking about preemptive war back then, using the military muscle of the United States to sort of discipline the world and enforce its interests around the world. The Middle East has always been a highly strategic area for the U.S., and until there's peace in the Middle East, and it has to be a just peace, there will never be, real security. I was at a talk that Howard Zinn gave last night at the Cooper Union, and he talked about how the history of the United States, how it has engaged in imperialistic wars around the world in just about, every decade or so. The United States has to, if it's going to change its destiny, it has to look at its militarism. It has to look at its imperial actions. And I talk about in the book, and this might be presumptuous as a Canadian, but, we live very close to you. We're very much affected by
you,
so maybe that
together.
Gives me a right. is that, Americans, they have this almost mythology about the goodness of the United States, that the United States only acts for good, and that the United States is the spreader of democracy around the world. I say that might be the tragic flaw of Americans, because it leads them to believe their leaders when they take them into unnecessary wars and create greater insecurity. This whole war on terrorism has exacerbated world insecurity, not just for your country, but for all countries. And it's a completely spurious adventure, because terrorism is by no means the major threat facing mankind at this time. If you look at State Department figures, which are said to be inflated over a sort of a 10-year period up to 2004, the number of deaths around the world caused by terrorist acts, this is globally, is about 700. Compare that to Katrina. Compare that to the people that are dying from the lack of health care, that are dying in Iraq. So, yes, it might be presumptuous of me to say that, but Americans need to hear it, because I think there's a large number of people in America that feel that way, and there's certainly a large number of people around the world that feel that way.
Maureen, this has been a true pleasure. We wish you the best of luck with your new book. It's Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, it looks great.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, really.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Professor John Ehrenberg, who's just written the book Servants of Wealth, The Rights Assault on Economic Justice. Can these policies of the last 25 years be broken? We're going to have, and John's going to join in with us to speak with our next guest, Stanley Aronowitz, who's written the book just out, Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Let's talk about, now that we know what the problem is, let's talk with Stanley Aronowitz about what he thinks the solution is.
America is in the midst of a crisis of democracy, as we literally descend into an authoritarian state. On Law and Disorder, we've seen firsthand the casualties of this crisis, from the growing militarization that pervades our lives to a dominant fundamentalism that cuts short critical thinking. Renowned social critic Stanley Aronowitz presents an alternative platform for our future in his recent book, Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. As we start the new year, we can borrow from the historical traditions of the European left, as well as the more recent trends in Latin America that are challenging, head-on, the death of socialism. Stanley Aronowitz is a professor of sociology, cultural studies, and urban education at the CUNY Graduate Center. He is also a veteran political activist and cultural critic, and a passionate champion of organized labor. In addition to authoring numerous books, he is a founding editor of Social Text, a journal that is subtitled Theory, Culture, Ideology.
Stanley, welcome to Law and Disorder. Why do you think we need a new political party? What's wrong with the notion of, you know, the Democrats are going to finally do something for us? And you don't believe that. Why don't you believe that?
Well,
what do you think we should do?
Yeah, obviously, Michael, the problem at this point is not whether the Democrats will or will not do something. They are likely to do something like, for example, increase the minimum wage, and it won't be enough, or they'll perhaps even play around with some version of universal health insurance, which will be probably terribly inadequate. That's not the problem. The problem is it's a conception of how things change. Things don't change, in my view, unless there's a force outside of the mainstream of society, that is the main ruling class parties, of which the Democratic Party is one, that forces the issues that need to be changed. And I'm even speaking about reform. Then when you get beyond reform, that is when you get to the problem of fundamental change, which we need, and John's book is a very good example, that is to address the issue of the growing gap between rich and poor, about the growing corporatization of virtually every nook and cranny, every itch and scratch of society, you're not going to get that change out of the mainstream political parties. You're going to have a new political party to force that change. So on both grounds, both the grounds of reform and fundamental radical social change, you need a party. Now, we have a left in this country. Half of it thinks it's going to push the Democratic Party to make at least the reform changes, and the other half thinks that the only way that you can force change is by resistance and protest. Protest and resistance are very necessary, I think. We need an anti-war movement. We need a movement that defends abortion. We need a movement that protects immigrant rights. But those movements need to connect with one another if we're going to get any kind of fundamental social change. That's the function of a political party. And none of those movements makes those connections because they tend to be movements that take on specific issues and sometimes do it well and sometimes do it not so well, but they take them on as if those issues are disconnected from every other issue. What the function of a radical political formation in the United States would be is to make those connections and to show people that the war is not separate from the problem of health and education and jobs and income, and people who are fighting for higher wages and for better working conditions can't address their issues fully without addressing the issue of the war. So those kinds of things have to be done by a political party, only a political party.
We're speaking with Professor Stanley Aronowitz, who's just written the book Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. How do we get there? What happened in the 30s when there was a huge rise of the working class in the United States, when the trade unions were formed, when even the women's movement or the black movement saw that their future went through the trade unions, when there was that kind of social consciousness? And then what happened to it and why? That's going to be my first question. Why didn't it work in the 30s? And then I'm going to ask you why it didn't work in the 60s. But answer my first one first, Stanley.
Well, the first
what happened
one
in the 30s?
The first one first has a single name. It's called the Communist Party. The Communist Party made a decision for reasons that have to do with the fight against fascism, their decision that their priority was to fight fascism and not fight for socialism or for fundamental social change. And the Communist Party made that decision about 1935 on a global level. And they decided that the big fight was to defeat Hitler and defeat fascism in Italy and in Spain and wherever else it arose. And they decided that in order to win that fight, they had to extend their hands to sections of capital and the middle class and to reformers and to liberals. And what they did at that point is they tucked their revolutionary political ideology, they tucked it under the mattress, hoping that one day it would reemerge. And actively, in many ways, actively discouraged the formation, a new political formation, which I think was clearly on the horizon for the reasons that you just have mentioned. I don't blame them entirely. I think part of another part of the reason is that the reform-minded labor leadership, who were both friendly to and outside of the Communist Party, or for that matter, the Socialist Party, got convinced that the Roosevelt coalition was as far as they could go in that period, and they decided to play in the Roosevelt or the New Deal Democratic Party-led coalition for a series of fairly substantial reforms. And they felt that if they went and became radical and stood really, in some sense, outside of the political system, they would get less. And I think that was a serious mistake.
And I agree with you, Stanley. And I'm gonna fast forward you 30 years. We're here in the studio with Michael Ratner, a veteran of the 60s radicalization.
Hi, Stanley. How are you?
Heidi Bogosian, who's a little younger than us but knows all about it. John Ehrenberg, who's our contemporary and a veteran as well. And me, Michael Smith. And we've got Stanley Aronowitz on the line. Professor Ehrenberg is here as a kind of a guest host to interview, and he's going to shoot in with a question. But before we get to the others,
talk about the 60s.
There's the second question I had. We didn't make it in the 30s. We were all part of the movement in the 60s, and we didn't make it then. My question is, why?
Well, I think in the 60s there were, you know, it was slightly different because it was, you should excuse the expression, us, the new left. Maybe not you, Michael, either, Michael, but it was us, the new left, who decided that the movements that had emerged, the civil rights, the black freedom movements, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the disability movements, that those were both necessary and sufficient. We decided that political parties, that partly the experience of Stalinism, that political parties were superfluous, in fact, more than superfluous, they were going to be a detriment to our forward march. And so we refused an attempt that was both within the movements, that is within the new left, as well as from outside, that is of some of the small political revolutionary parties like the Progressive Labor Party and others. We refused the attempt to transform the new left into a political formation of the kind that I've talked about.
Well, let's talk about now.
Well, now we've got a third problem, but you see, well, the third problem we have now is that the movements are much, much weaker than they were in the 1930s or the 1960s. And right now, what we have is a strong, I would call it, a social movement fetish, part of which is the result of same forces that produced our refusal in the 60s, and part of which is a conscious kind of anarchist view that we don't want political parties because they'll be bureaucratic and authoritarian. And because of the weakness on the one hand and the ideological opposition to political formations itself, both electoral as well as non-electoral, we are facing the problem now of a very fragmented and a very isolated left, both isolated from the mainstream of American society, but also isolated from each other. What we need to do is get started, and I have a proposal in the book on how to get started, and it will sound very, very difficult for people, but I think it's the only way to go.
We're speaking with Stanley Aronowitz, author of the newly published Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. The four of us are sitting here, Stanley, asking you the ultimate question, how do you get started?
Well, the way you get started is that every one of you, the four of you who are in different parts of the various movements and institutions of the left, take some time and form a study group, not only around my book, although my book is a good starting point, but around some of the classical readings on revolutionary and radical political formations. I mean Lenin, I mean Luxembourg, I mean Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin, who had a debate. I mean Marx himself in the Communist Manifesto. I mean, various recent places where these issues of organization, of political organization, have been raised, have study groups which are connected to one another, and at some point, perhaps a year from now, maybe 18 months, 2 years, have a conference and have people start to talk about what they learned at that conference or what they are hoping to learn from the history both of the American left as well as the history of the world radical and revolutionary movements in terms of the kind of political formation that we need. I think part of that reading has got to be the utopian thinking that I suggest in the last chapter. I think part of that thinking has got to be books like Michael Albert's Paracon, like Gar Alperovitz's Beyond Capitalism, Seymour Melman's After Capitalism, and even the history of utopian thinking that goes back to the 19th century.
Stanley, let me ask you a question. This is John Ehrenberg.
Yeah.
I should say at the outset that I came out of a different trend in the 60s left than you did. I actually was part of a Marxist-Leninist party-building attempt for many, many years. And I, like you, I was in this for like 15 years. So I was never a fan of the anarchistic social movement-y kind of orientation of the new left. And I actually didn't ever define myself as a new leftist precisely for that reason. We tried to make our connection to the old working class history of the properly speaking American left. So I agree with you thoroughly about the need for an organized political apparatus that can raise these general questions and speak in a comprehensive way and provide a context within which all of these particular and narrow and individual struggles can be carried on and understood. But having said that, I have to confess to a healthy skepticism about this at this point, and I want to ask you this question. People who talk about the need for a third party.
I'm not talking about a third party. Go ahead.
All right, well, let me rephrase it.
I'm not talking about a third electoral party as the basis anyway. In the book, I argue against the focus, the primary focus, on electoralism. That's not what I'm interested in. And I think that would be a mistake.
All right. So tell the listeners how your notion differs from the old notions of a third electoral party.
Because it's based on a much older radical tradition, which says that out of the social movements, that is, out of the workers' movement, out of the the feminist movement, out of the freedom movements, the black and Latino and other kinds of freedom movements, has got to come a sense of coordination and of connection. It's got to come out of the groundswell, or at least out of the base of the political of the movements. But the difference between me and the movement fetish is that I would argue that they have to form, they have to develop a political formation. Now, what would the political formation do? I mean, it would be a formation that would fight for health care and fight for various changes in the society, but it would fight for it in an organized fashion. It would fight for it by making connections, and first and foremost, it would fight for it by creating a weekly and finally a daily newspapers, various kinds of publications, books and magazines and pamphlets and everything else, a large educational effort to convince people, the American people and the left itself, that social change is not only desirable but necessary. Now, what we don't have in this country that we had in the 60s, one of the reasons I think we didn't have a party is because we had a National Guardian. We have The Guardian. And it was a weekly newspaper. I don't mean The Nation, which is a left liberal magazine of opinion. I mean, we had a weekly newspaper. We had, in the teens of the 20th century, we had dailies. Even in the 30s, you had the Daily Worker. You can't do that without a political formation unless you have rich people.
Stanley, let me interrupt you a second. One of the problems that I've seen in the last 10 years is that we have, say, several anti-war groups. And there's a lot of infighting, to be quite honest.
That's right. Competition.
I don't know whether the internet has helped foment this with, internet campaigns and going after the same funders. How would you deal with that?
Well, I'm not interested in funders.
Well, I mean competition with an ideology.
My proposal is that 25,000 people put up between $5, $10, $15, $20, $100, $200, $500, put it out of their own pocket, no funders to speak of. I mean, I wouldn't turn down funders, but essentially this has to be people taking money out of their own pocket and saying, we need a national newspaper to start with. I mean, this is, why don't we have a national newspaper? It's because people are interested in individual movements. So because they're interested in the Democratic Party, they got a national Democratic Party newspaper. It's called, it's not a newspaper, a magazine of opinion. It's called The Nation. Every time you turn around and say, we need a new political formation, people like Van den Heuvel and others at The Nation say, no, 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 that's terrible. We don't want that. What we have to do is change the Democratic Party. We need a formation, because without a formation, we're not going to be able to provide the kind of news as well as the kind of, I mean, it would be online as well as hard copy, the kind of news as well as the kind of agitation as well as the kind
Stanley,
of
Stanley, 1 second. This is Michael speaking. I'm interested in John's opinion about this, because I don't know if he really chimed in here about whether, I mean, I know you don't necessarily believe we're working within the Democratic Party, and you believe you have to push it from outside, but you agree with Stanley?
I'm not pushing it from outside.
No, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about John. And I wasn't talking to you, Stanley, about okay. I mean, to you. I was talking about John about it. I'm just interested in John's thoughts about your views, not just about the newspaper, about these Democratic formations and whether that's a way to go.
I think that Stanley's absolutely right. We need some kind of political way of thinking that can enable all of these isolated social – and they are awfully isolated, not just from each other, but they're isolated from the general population as well. We need a way of enabling them to talk to each other and to talk to the general population. And the way to do that is the only sphere of thought and action that makes that possible is politics, because it focuses on the general issues. And this goes all the way back to Aristotle. So when I listen to Stanley talk, I'm reminded of Lenin. Lenin proposed building the party around the newspaper.
There's a very
famous moment in the 1905 revolution when Lenin is talking about this mass revolution in 1905 that featured spontaneous workers' strikes and factory occupations. It featured peasant risings. It featured student demonstrations and strikes and sit-ins and whatnot. And Lenin addresses, in Pravda, Lenin addresses the question, how are we going to get all of these different elements to talk to each other? Now, this is a time when the Bolsheviks are pretty weak and pretty isolated. And he says the way to do it is you have to conduct a kind of agitation and propaganda that will enable students to understand that supporting workers is in their immediate direct interest, and in which peasants have to be made to understand that students' demands for democracy on campus is directly in the interest, in the self-interest of the peasantry. Now, there's only one way to do this, Lenin said, and that is you've got to focus upon the state, the nature of the state, and the requirements of political democracy. And that's – now, he wasn't talking from the standpoint of the leader of a strong, powerful party, but what he was saying was that the only – political apparatus which can do this is an apparatus that is rooted in the working class, because only the working class can really raise these issues in the broad, comprehensive way that is necessary. The problem I have with what Stanley is saying is that, and I think this is the central problem the left needs to address, is the so-called question of agency. Who's going to do it?
Yeah,
it's,
well, look,
at
you
a
know,
time at a time when the organized working class is least organized and least developed and least politically powerful in the last 50 years. So, and I think that's something that left has to do. I love Stanley's notions, and I love these ideas of getting people to think politically and organize themselves. But, you know, when Irving Kristol in 1979 said to business, you got to think politically and you got to organize newspapers and conferences and think tanks and whatnot, he's speaking to people who actually had a mass institutional base and actually had somewhere to go with all this, and they did it and they ran with it. I'm not sure, Stanley, frankly, that we're in this kind of position at the moment. And I think this question of the relationship between the social movements and the Democratic Party remains an open question.
Stanley, your response?
Yeah, John, look, the only thing, my short answer is it's never a good time. It was not a good time in the 30s. It was not a good time in the 60s. It's never a good time. There are always people, and well-meaning people, and people with good, solid arguments who will say, the movement's too weak, the working class is too weak, this is not the time. I agree with you, but it's not. And I would have to, I'm not a Zionist at all, but I'll have to go back to a very old phrase, if not now, when? No. Let me just finish. If you don't have an organized and you have to read the book. I'm sorry. It really is important that you do that, because I talk about the working class. I talk about the labor movement, and I'm going to make an argument that which says you're not going to have a strong labor movement in the United States without a detachment of that labor movement being this political formation of which we speak. We're not going to have a revival of the feminist movement for the same reason. You can't depend on spontaneity. You got some good unions, bad unions, and different unions. But the difficulty is that those unions are under the under essentially a business leadership right now, and there are exceptions, but not many. And I would say if you don't have a serious rank and file movement in the labor movement, then that rank and file movement has to come out of political formation. It's really, unless it becomes a factional movement, which is true of a number of the places, you're not going to have a strong labor movement. You're not going to have a strong anti-war movement, nothing. And that's the basic argument.
Stanley, thank you. We're going to wind up now. I'm going to ask everybody sitting at this roundtable for their last thoughts and remind our listeners that we've been speaking with Stanley Aronowitz, who has written the book Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Before that, we spoke with John Ehrenberg, who wrote Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. And then John joined us in this roundtable discussion with Stanley. And I'm going to go around the room here and ask people for their final thoughts on this. And Stanley, we're going to finish up with you as our guest for this segment. But John Ehrenberg, what are your final thoughts on this topic?
Well, I think Stanley's absolutely right in a general sense. I do think that some kind of organized political presence from outside the established political parties is just absolutely crucial. I think where I'm a little more skeptical than he is how it will be done. But Stanley, I'm going to read your book. And
you
asked me to do so. And in fairness to you, I will do so. You read mine. Yeah. I will read yours.
Okay.
And Heidi, your final thoughts.
I love Stanley's ideas. I agree. I do think we have many opportunities with the internet to try to move forward on some of this. I know the National Lawyers Guild will do our best to rouse everyone else.
And Michael Ratner, do you have any final thoughts on the topic?
My only worry here is that the internet actually, I think, has a possibility of decreasing organizing and mass protest, because people think by sending in emails and reading, you know, Alternet or something, that they're doing something, when in fact, I think you want to get people into the streets, and at least that's one of my beefs with the internet.
No, I agree with you on that. The last word goes to Stanley Aronowitz, author of Left Turn. Before Stanley speaks his mind, we want to thank John Ehrenberg for coming down and being on Law and Disorder. Michael, Heidi, thank you. And Stanley, you got the last word.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's going to be an easy road, but I believe that the road has to start getting taken, because if the road is not taken, the left is going to continue to disintegrate. And part of that disintegration is due to the fact that people have been allowed by various electronic means to sit back. And I think face-to-face interaction is absolutely necessary, and I think political formation is urgent.
Thank you, Stanley.
Thanks, Stanley.
You're welcome.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
As real as it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains. Who denies of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation, all you ever gave my people was salvation, fathers of this country never cared for me, they kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery, and Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me, except lie about the facts in my history, so now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed, but the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down, so they can screw us around, time to change the government now, Panther power, Panther power. American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. The Ku Klux Klan tried to keep us out. We signed truth and state no blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation was the way for our freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the other of skin, yeah, don't sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your Panther power that makes you a star. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power.
power. Panther power. My mother never let me forget my history, hoping I was set free. Chains that were put on me, wanted to be more than just free. Had to know the true facts about my history. I couldn't settle for being a statistic. Couldn't survive in this capitalistic government, cause it was meant to hold us back. Using ignorance, drugs, the sneak attack in my community. They killed the unity, but when I charge them, try to claim immunity. I strike America like a case of heart disease. Panther power is running through my arteries. Try to stop me, oh boy, you'll be clawed to death, cause I'll be fighting for my freedom with my dying breath. Do you remember? That's what I'm asking you. You think you're living free? Don't make me laugh at you. Open your eyes, realize you've been locked in chains. Said you wasn't civilized and stole your name. Cause some time has passed, seem to all forget. There is no liberty for you and me, we ain't free yet. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. As real as it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains, to deny us of the future, rob our name. Kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me. Cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me. Promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery. And now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman. Cause I'm strong and bold with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told. Promised me emancipation and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me, except lie about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy it when my people are down, so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power. From the rebel to you.